It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farid. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about a state grant program that's bringing high-tech manufacturing tools into public schools.
First, there's been a substantial increase in the number of heroin-related deaths throughout Wisconsin in recent years, but there has been a considerable spike in Milwaukee County.
Between 2012 and 2015, 888 people died in Milwaukee County due to heroin or opioid-related overdoses. A new initiative announced this week will bring together various departments and organizations in Milwaukee to address and hopefully reduce the problem.
Michael Murphy is the alderman for Milwaukee's 10th District, and he joins us now to talk about new resolutions to reduce the incidence of heroin-related deaths in Milwaukee. Alderman Murphy, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me on your program.
Well, first of all, how big of a problem has heroin become in Milwaukee County?
Well, it's huge, to put it mildly. When you think that we have lost 888 people in the last 3 years, that's more than nearly triple the number of homicides, certainly more than double the number of automobile accidents. And since 2005, it's been a 500% increase. So opiates and heroin are becoming one of the leading causes of deaths in our community. And it strikes all different groups. Most people probably don't realize that the average age of somebody dying in Milwaukee County is a 43-year-old white male. Over 60% of the opiate and heroin deaths are generally to people of Caucasian, about 30% African-American, a smaller portion in Latino. And it is a shocking number, and one in which I believe we should be looking at this issue as a public health epidemic. And that's why I solicited and worked to receive a grant from the Milwaukee Medical College.
Now, the problem in Milwaukee isn't unique to Milwaukee or even to Wisconsin. It's something that's happening nationwide. But looking at Milwaukee, what do you see changing there to cause this spike in numbers?
Well, I think it's very similar to the national numbers. But what we've seen and evidence has supported that is that we had for many, many years people that were receiving illegal narcotic, oxycodone. And as a result of more pressure on physicians and medical establishments to limit the individuals receiving that drug, people have a very difficult time getting it. And as a result, oxycodone on the streets of Milwaukee, like major cities around the country, is much more expensive than heroin. And heroin has gone down in price. And people have moved to heroin. And so we have a lot of people who are from all walks of profession now using heroin. And we find it's driving a lot of the crime in our city. And we see a lot of suburbanites from not only the outer ring of Milwaukee, but from all parts of the state coming into the Milwaukee area to buy their heroin, and they're driving a lot of crime. And as a result, we need to do a better job than how we've been focusing our efforts mainly on a law enforcement aspect on this issue. We're never going to arrest our way out of this situation. It has to be a much more of a collective approach, viewing this as a public health risk.
And speaking of collective approach, you're reaching out and having this partnership with the Milwaukee Medical College. What would that partnership look like?
Well, the medical college has awarded me $50,000, and I put in $50,000 in our city budget, and I'm hopeful going to be raising another $50,000 in private money. We're hiring an epidemiologist. The report that I had published a few months ago, I worked with the medical examiner in Milwaukee County, Brian Peterson, and asked him to give me the data, and we sorted it and did a demographic study, and we looked for patterns of what are those patterns can tell us and teach us as to whether or not we can use that data to make better informed decisions. I'm a big believer in letting data drive our policy decisions, so having an epidemiologist and having the research capability of the medical college to look at this issue. So they're doing a collective review of all the research in the country for best practices. That's a short-term goal, and then look at whether or not we should be implementing some of those best practices here in Milwaukee. Little things in the data that I couldn't dive into that were very concerning. We see a substantial increase in benzos, anti-anxiety drugs, being found in the toxicology reports of people who have been dying. Why is that occurring? We see a bit of a plateau in those last year in heroin deaths. Is that because of Narcan being used and made more readily available in the community? Fentanyl, which is a drug that's 100 times more powerful than morphine, and from 2011 through the 2012 through the end of the last year, we had a total of 30 cases of fentanyl being one of the leading causes of deaths in the toxicology reports. Just in the last 3 months, it's now 60. So, what is going on? And how is that drug getting into our city and then distributed? What fentanyl is such a deadly drug. Why is that occurring? What strategies we should learn from that and how law enforcement but also public health providers should be aware of. So there's a lot of data, but how to use it wisely and having epidemiologists help us guide us and the police department on how we use those resources, I think is critical.
So you mentioned looking at best practices. Are there cities that or areas of the country that have been particularly effective at getting a handle on heroin deaths?
Well, I think there is some lessons to be learned. So for one thing, we already implemented was we put in drop-off boxes at all our police district stations for people to take their prescription medicines. We know entryway into heroin really is through legal prescriptions, but a lot of young people get it through the medicine cabinet, either through their parents or more likely from their grandparents. And so if we can get those medicines out of the medicine cabinets and into a proper location is really important. One of my colleagues, Alderman Jim Bull, has done great work on this issue, and I'm working collaboratively with him. We're going to have a program, one of the first in the country, where CVS Pharmacy is going to work with us to have envelopes be provided to Alderman to take to Black Watch meetings, to where we can go and distribute these. It was very sealed envelopes where people can empty their medicines and just mail them back to the police department, where then they will be properly disposed of. That, I think, is some of the things we're looking for best practices around the country, and perhaps we'll be one of the leaders in that.
We're talking with Michael Murphy right now, Alderman for Milwaukee's 10th District, and he's talking with us about a new proposed partnership, some money being pooled there for the city of Milwaukee to use a database approach to combat heroin-related deaths in the city. And I know one area that you're looking at is focusing on families and friends of people who may be developing heroin addictions. Why are you targeting those people?
Well, I have met with so many moms and fathers who have lost children, and I think there's just such a huge sense of frustration, sometimes a lot of shame, and they don't know where to go and turn to. And so I think trying to disseminate and provide those resources out to those individuals to provide that support. I've heard from parents who end up blaming themselves. They feel they weren't enough tough love. They weren't doing enough. You know, in many cases, a lot of these individuals got hooked on these drugs through going to the doctor. And so I think people, we need to reach out to them and share with them other resources to allow them to have the ability to make different decisions. You know, the only silver lining in this whole issue on the opiate addiction that I can tell you is, you know, and I wasn't really around for it so much, but in the 80s, you know, the crack epidemic was horrific on the African-American community, and the solution back then was simply to lock everybody up and throw away the key. I mean, the only saving grace and the only silver lining now is just people have a better understanding, and perhaps it's also attributed to the fact that this is affecting a lot of the white middle-class community, and then the attitude is, well, let's look at potential options of treatment and prevention. So that's the only silver lining I see of this whole debate, but those are some of the things that I'm focusing on.
And Alderman Murphy, just very briefly, when does this partnership go into effect, when you start taking action and looking at data?
Yesterday. So the money was approved. The medical college has already hired two individuals. I'm hopeful to raise additional private money. The one thing, I wish we could do more, but the reality is, you know, the state of Wisconsin, this is a shocking statistic. We're one of the last states in the country for the amount of money we put into public health. I think Mississippi beats us now. So we're either 49 or 50. So I can't rely on the state of Wisconsin for any help on this. So we have to look at building better partners with the people in our region. So I'm working with private foundation, work with the medical college, the city of Milwaukee is putting money into this. And we have to recognize we have to do better than what we're currently doing in this state and in this city.
Alderman Murphy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Michael Murphy is the alderman from Milwaukee's 10th District, and he was with us there to talk about new proposed actions that the city of Milwaukee will be taking to curb heroin-related deaths.
Coming up, learn how state grants are putting more 3D printers, mini mills, and other fabrication equipment in schools. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, our guest shares some flavor-filled Latin cooking that's good for your taste buds and for your health, with some recipes made for people managing diabetes in particular.
First, Wisconsin is set to lead the country in having the most fabrication labs, or fab labs, in public schools.
The state recently provided thousands of dollars in grants to 25 school districts across the state to build these so-called fab labs, which include equipment like 3D printers, plasma cutters, and mini mills.
The goal of the labs is to provide students a hands-on learning experience focused on skills related to STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math. Republican State Representative Mary Chaya from Irma was a major supporter of these grants. She joins us now to talk about the labs. Representative Chaya, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. How are you today?
Well, I'm good. Well, tell us about these fab labs. First, I guess let's start with the basics. What is a fab lab?
Oh, okay. So you're going to get the generic non-technical version.
And that's the one I want.
Okay. So it's fabrication laboratory. And what it is, it's a lab that has design computers that have like designing programs on them. And then it's 3D printers and CNC machines and routers and all kinds of like what you'd see in manufacturing or like see in labs. And then the big deal is a 3D printer.
Right. These are catching on. I see those in more and more places now. Now, you were a big supporter of funding to make this happen. Why do you think it's important to have these fabrication labs accessible to students and school districts?
Well, the best example is Three Lakes, Wisconsin, little bitty Three Lakes. They have a K-12 school district all in one building. And Dr. Carling, who is their superintendent up there, he was working with a gentleman, his name is Don Sladowski, and Don is, you know, really promoting the broadband expansion in rural areas for economic growth and fab labs. And Don came to me and told me about this. Now, MIT University actually came out with a fab lab model. And in order to be an MIT certified fab lab, it's a public-private partnership. So all your funding does not come through government. It has to come through the private sector. So what Three Lakes did is they went all out and they put in an amazing fab lab, and then they've got private sector support for it. And they did it all on their own. And what's happening, if you could read Dr. Carling's report, in the 3 years that they've had this fab lab in, number one, test scores are going up, truancies and detentions are going down. It's literally changing how they're educating kids. If you think... He uses the term that our education process is almost punitive, and that's not what we wanted, but that's how things have turned out. See, if you you sit in a seat, you learn and learn and learn, you know, your math problems, and then you take a test. If you make a mistake on that one test, say you're having an off day, that sticks with you. Where the Fab Labs is a hands-on trial and error. If you don't, you get a project, and then you have to solve that project. If you don't solve it the first time, that doesn't mean you failed. You learned how not to solve it, and you can go on to the next one. And they have 4K preschool kindergartners that are designing ornaments online, printing them out, and making them for their parents.
No kidding.
So what it's doing is it's taking away the stigma of science, technology, engineering, and math. You know, my daughter is 25, and even when she was going through school, but especially when I was in earlier generations, I mean, engineering is for boys. Engineering is too hard. Engineering is scary. We're starting them out engineering in kindergarten. And they just, you know, it's kind of like your kids can use a computer better than you. They have no fear, and they just move right through it. So with this budget, we had $500,000 that went into the biennial budget cycle for fab labs. And we thought if we could get 6 to 10 labs a year, we would really be transforming. And in order to qualify for the grant process, it couldn't just be a superintendent and principal. We had to have a full resolution by the school board because we really wanted school board buy-in. We had 94 grant applications.
Did you expect that kind of response? 94 different school districts applying for this?
Yeah, no. We thought if we got 10 or 15, it would be a miracle.
So this is something that schools are excited about, it sounds like.
Yes, very much so. And if you think about it, you know, the 4.0 students learn traditionally, you know, where they sit and they learn. But we have a whole segment of kids that I will call non-traditional learners that are hands-on learners and problem solvers by doing, not just by listening and hearing. And this is giving these kids an opportunity. And that's the class of kids that are really, really excelling the most. Is maybe your C-minus, even D to B student in that area. And I look at this as, you know, it's got so many positive effects. Let me tell you then about Florence County, another mm-hmm. very small school district in northern Wisconsin. 3 years ago, Florence was on the verge of filing for dissolution because they couldn't meet their behemoths, you know, low enrollment, declining enrollment. So community got together and they formed one countywide district, and things have turned around out there. Well, their superintendent, Ben Niehaus, saw this at Three Lakes and said, Florence County needs to do this. So they did, and they've got a public-private partnership. Now, they went in a lot with a lot less expensive lab than what Three Lakes was able to do. And this has gotten up and running. Well, now that the snowbirds have returned from that area, retired engineers, retired consultants, retired chemists, you know, and Florence does a real good job of marketing their fab lab to the community. These retired engineers are in, like, volunteering and helping with the students solve problems and do projects. In addition to that, then businesses are coming in, and they're working with the students and these retired engineers. And it's just really like a community-centered project. And it's positive for the kids, positive for retirees, it's positive for the business. So now they have a gentleman that came back home to visit family. He owns a business that, I don't know what his business is, but he gave them, I will give you an order for 2,000 keychains. They had to do cost accounting, order products, order supplies, mm-hmm. you know, figure the cost of manufacture, figure the cost of packaging, and then mailing out to him. So they had to bid the work, perform the work, and mail it all out. They made a profit on their job, which then went right back into the fab lab. So instead of just doing math problems, they're doing hands-on problem solving.
We're talking to State Representative Mary Chaya about fabrication labs and state funding to help schools set them up. And, you know, I thought when I heard about this, oh, this is going to be focused on vocational skills, and students will clearly learn a lot of that. But it sounded like you were saying in Three Lakes, it's not just that, that kids are doing better overall in school. They're more enthusiastic about school, period.
Well, wouldn't you like to do something like that than sit in a class, sit in a desk for 8 hours a day? Yeah, I mean, you know, and it's they do, and they work in teams, so they learn to work in teams, and it's problem solving. As an example, in Montemita, Minnesota, they've had a fab lab for quite a while. There was a young man working on a project, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but in also to be an MIT Fab Lab, you have to be connected to the worldwide, I'll call it Fab Lab Internet, just because I'm not sure the correct name. So he found out that a young man in India was working on the same, like, problem. So here they're talking from Minnesota to India. So it's also, like, integrating kids at a younger age with the world. And they're cohabitating, or not cohabitating, but cooperating work mm-hmm. on a project.
I understand as part of the grants, the districts need to make the labs available not just to the schools, but to community members. They have access to it, too? How does that work?
Well, so because it's partly funded by communities and businesses, the businesses have access, like in Three Lakes, I think it's Tuesdays and Thursdays, and then for special occasions on Saturday, Tuesday and Thursday evenings. So they can come in, and if say you're a little job shop and you're trying to design a piece of metal or a part or whatever, you can use the design and then the CNC machines and the routers. So it's helping the public or the private sector, and plus it's helping the public sector. And that's a way to get these businesses to buy into the school and the project.
Do you have plans to try to get even more expanded funding for this, given the high level of interest you're getting from school districts?
Yes. And also, I actually have a meeting with Governor Walker in June. And one of the things I want to talk to him about is we used up the entire $500,000 in this that we had put into the biennium budget, plus WEDC put additional funds in there. And so we don't have any money set aside for the second round of the budget. And I'm going to see if we can't, if Governor Walker can't help us find some money. I don't want to lose out on this because this is, I mean, we are moving forward. This puts Wisconsin at the leading edge. We have more fab labs in the state of Wisconsin. We have like 37 fab labs than any other state in the United States. And we have some of the only K-12 fab labs in the nation and the world.
Do you have hopes for what this could mean for the state economy and maybe local economies where they have these fab labs?
Absolutely. I think what the trend we're seeing in education is, you know, we've kind of focused on everybody as college prep. And I think this will allow kids maybe to come right out and go to work if that's what they want. It's more of a trained workforce and, you know, a hands-on trained and a problem-solving workforce. And I think as Wisconsin continues to produce that type of workforce, you will see businesses wanting to invest and grow their businesses in Wisconsin because we're going to have the people that are ready to go to work for them without maybe some of the debt load that we've seen on kids in the past. And, you know, Dr. Lori Wires at North Technical College, Central Technical College in Wausau gives a good example. Her son had a full-ride scholarship for basketball to the University of Milwaukee. That's not where he wanted to go. He wanted to be a firefighter. So he ended up at Fox Valley Technical College, became a firefighter, and then went on to finish his bachelor's and everything else, and now he's a captain. And just because you don't get a four-year degree right out of the gate doesn't mean that you stop learning. You know, a lot of people, once they find their niche in life and what they like to do, then they go on and get their degree. And sometimes I think we do it a little bit backwards, where we get a degree and then you try to figure out what you like to do. So this is kind of helping maybe people find out what they like to do before they dive into that four-year degree and a lot of debt for college.
Representative Chaya, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm so excited about this. It's unreal. I think it's going to transform our state.
That was State Representative Mary Chaya talking about high-tech fabrication labs in Wisconsin schools.
Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday, and we talked to a chef about Cuban cooking with some special tips for people trying to eat healthy, diabetes-friendly food. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. By the way, thank you so much to everyone who contributed during our spring membership drive over the last few days. More than 1,600 listeners pledged, including nearly, and this is great, 400 new members to Wisconsin Public Radio. You donated in all more than $222,000 to fund the Wisconsin Public Radio programs you depend on. And remember, there was that plant a tree thing. Over 350 trees will be planted around Wisconsin State Forest. So thank you so much for your very kind support. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll get a rundown on the biggest headlines from around Wisconsin this week.
First, it is Friday, therefore it is Food Friday. Our next guest is a former U.S. Marine, now a Cuban-Colombian-American classically trained chef who specializes in healthy Cuban-style cooking.
And if you have questions about Cuban cooking or have some recipes to share, you can give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Again, our number is 800-642-1234.
Chef Ronaldo Linares is the executive chef of Martino's Cuban restaurant in Somerville, New Jersey. His new book, Chef Ronaldo's Sabores to Cuba, came out this month, and it's a guide to diabetes-friendly Cuban cuisine. It's written in both Spanish and English. Chef Ronaldo, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure, my pleasure. Great to be here among the cheeseheads of America from Green Bay, for sure.
Well, tell us a little bit about your philosophy on cooking. It seems like, one, cooking is a way of life for you, and two, cooking is a lot of fun for you.
Definitely hit both on the head there. I mean, cooking itself, I love it. I mean, without food, you can't live, so why not do it delicious? And as far as being a way of life, you know, it's been like that since I was born. I feel like I was born in the kitchen. So I was born, came out of the womb into the kitchen, peeling potatoes, washing dishes, and just watching my father do his thing.
Wait, tell us about some of those early days, because your journey started in Colombia. What was your experience with food like when you were growing up?
The food was abundant, thank God. I mean, it was in Colombia was going in literally probably every 3 days. We go to the market in the main city. I lived in Medellin, and we will go and just imagine a New York City block, right? But inside that block, it's a huge, huge market. You'll find anywhere from artisanal products, spices, meats, produce. Every produce you could think in the world was located in there. So I definitely, my mom would tell me, go pick out the mangoes, the oranges, the platanos, and all that. She would tell me how to pick them out, and I would get them. If I came back with a plantain that was not perfectly ripe, it would not be good news for me. Put it that way.
Well, let's get to some of the Cuban cooking now. What are some of the main flavors, the main ingredients that show up a lot in the Cuban food you're cooking?
Man, you're going to find, well, one of the things that changed was on the oils. And we usually use canola oil and stuff. Put a lot of avocado oil in there. The avocado oil is very flavorful, and plus it has a lot of nutritional value. Besides that, you're going to find a lot of cumin, oregano, bay leaf, and, of course, salt and pepper. But, like, that cumin, that oregano and bay leaf, I mean, it's definitely something that I grew up with. My father puts it in just about everything. And the good thing about that it takes its own flavor in every single dish a different way. It's not going to taste the same. It enhances the product. So that's why I love it so much, because it's so versatile.
And you want people to go to the farmer's market, to continue making this sort of farm-to-table cooking like it was when you were growing up. What is it about that farmer's market cooking that you think is so great?
I mean, being able to go to the farmers, your local farmers market, or get to travel around the area. In New Jersey, we have a lot of them. So I love taking my son, my wife, we go, and I just go down there and picking and choosing what you like. And sometimes you find some local meat vendors there, and then get a pick of the good stuff, and as well as the vegetables. And you get stuff that you don't usually find in your ShopRites of Wegmans or the World, and it's just helping, and also you're helping the farmer out, you know, kind of the circle of life kind of way. I say that because I watch a lot of Lion Guard with my son, so it's kind of like the circle of life, and you know, helping everybody out in the community. You get to meet people, a lot more people like that, and it's just a great way to get inspired. You know, definitely one of the things you get inspired.
Now, in this cookbook, you're not just cooking Cuban food. You're trying to make diabetes-friendly traditional-style Cuban food. Why is that a focus for you?
Because it's the way that I think people get excited about cooking. So the book is bilingual, as you mentioned. So the cool thing about that is the Spanish side will reconnect a lot of people to their roots, whether they're Cuban, Colombian, Puerto Rican, Brazilian, doesn't matter. There's a lot of familiar flavors there. Just a little bit of a different technique. So it kind of helps them reconnect to that in a delicious way. And once Latinos feel like the book is coming from a good place. It's coming from a place of culinary history, that they will stick to it. And as far as on the non-Latino side, it's introducing them to flavors and to different techniques and to a cuisine that is getting really hot right now, of course, with everything that's happening with Cuba, but also adding a different style of flavor to their everyday eating. So that was very important to me, to hit both people. And the diet, just, you know, one thing about being diabetic friendly, the only thing that makes the book diabetic friendly is that each recipe goes with the guidelines, with the ADA guidelines, with the nutritional guidelines, right? So there's no cutting. There's some cutting back on certain things, but I've been able, with the use of spices and technique and experience, being able to bring a lot of bang for little dinero, as they say, you know.
Would you say that Cuban food lends itself particularly well to being friendly for diabetics, or did you have to do a lot of tweaking?
No, not at all. I didn't. I mean, I've been cooking this way for a long, long time, and that's why I got inspired to do this, because, man, like, this is I think this is pretty diabetic friendly. So when I did the whole book, I handed in my manuscript. I got, you know, I was waiting for the nutritional analysis, right? They're like, we're going to do the nutritional analysis. Wait. And I'm like, oh, my God, I'm going to have to, like, redo every single recipe, you know? I stuck pretty good to the recipes and everything. So I got back the book, the manuscript with the corrections, and maybe 30% of the book I had to redo, and it wasn't bad. I was off, like, by 1 gram of fat, by, like, 10 milligrams of salt. I mean, if it doesn't hit the number, I got to redo it. So, it pretty much, I could say it lends itself to diet. Done right, cooked right, it definitely lends itself to the diabetic community.
Talking to Chef Ronaldo Linares. His new book is Chef Ronaldo's Sabores to Cuba. It's Cuban cooking, diabetes-friendly Cuban cooking. I'm going to get to recipes in just a moment, Ronaldo, but I want to get to your top four kitchen essentials here. A smile, love, music, I'm with you so far, and I've seen you on video, a good outfit. You dress snazzy. I'm scared. I mean, I'm a slob to begin with. I don't want to wear my nice stuff because I'm going to get food all over it. How do you manage that?
That's the thing. You know, you got some good stuff on, so you're definitely not gonna get dirty. As you can see in all my stuff, I'm always looking good, and I think that is a key, man. Everybody, if you have people coming over, you're looking good. They're gonna feel good. They're gonna be like, man, this guy is taking care. Look at him. He's cooking. He's not dirty. And it's just a good. It just kind of sets up a good time. And then that's why I put those are the four main things to cook an awesome meal, you know, because you're taking it serious. You're going in there to get something done, you know?
Well, let's dig into your recipes now. You've got a slow cooker chicken and rice recipe that you say it takes only 10 minutes to prep. Can you walk us through that one?
So, I mean, from the cutting of the chicken itself, I mean, it's chicken breast, so it's already skinned and everything. So, you know, cueing it up, the rice itself, you know, all you have to do is measure it, rinse it up, put in the pressure cooker. And as far as your ingredients, you know, just kind of cutting them up, that takes, I think that's right there, the cutting part, the prep time, that's what takes the longest. But besides that, I mean, gathering your spices, once you have that, you know, one thing that I tell people, get your ingredients, everything ready in front of you before you start the cooking. Because if you start, let's say you put the rice in and like, oh my God, I got to get the chicken, and you cut the chicken, and then that 10-minute prep time is going to turn into 20 minutes and it's going to turn into a bad dish. So that 10 minutes is gathering all your ingredients. The French would like to say, mise en place, you know, be fancy about it. But just gather the ingredients, put them in front of you. That would take just about 10 minutes. Just kind of dump it in the pressure cooker, stir it, seal it, hit cook, and just, you know, for that beep, open up that lid, kind of get a fork to fluff it up, and then that's it. You're done. And the dish is unbelievable. And the thing about, like, the pressure cooker, like, the flavor kind of just explodes in there because it doesn't escape anywhere. It stays in there. It kind of drips the steam in there. A little bit of the condensation drips over the chicken, the rice. So you get a little bit of basting going on there. There's a lot of things going inside a pressure cooker. So when you do eat it, you get this explosion of flavors.
And yeah, this is pretty straightforward ingredients. Your chicken breast, you mentioned, brown rice, vegetables and onions, and then some of those herbs you mentioned. You've got the cumin, the bay leaves, the oregano, and that avocado oil again. What's the flavor that adds? What is it? What is so important about that avocado oil?
Well, the avocado oil is going to add definitely nutrition content to it. Your omegas, anti-inflammatory, and it's good for the blood, right? Besides that, it has a smoke point at 500 degrees. Why is that important? Because like olive oil, it's very low smoke point. I think like 250 or something. So you get carcinogens, right? The cancer causing stuff. So you want a high quality oil. Olive oil is good for salads. It's perfect for salads. But as for cooking, I think avocado oil takes king. And you're able to, unless the smokiness of the avocado to it, because the way they press it and everything, and you get this like kind of buttery flavor to it. So it's really, really good. And it just adds this beautiful shine and moistness to the dish. So definitely avocado oil is the way to go.
We're talking to Chef Fernando Linares, a classically trained chef specializing in healthy Cuban cooking. His new book, Chef Ronaldo Sabores de Cuba, is out now, and it's a guide to diabetes-friendly traditional and new Cuban cuisine.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Tell us if you have any recipes of your own that you'd like to share, or maybe you're new to Cuban cooking, want to know how to make it more healthy or diabetes-friendly. You have some questions for Chef Ronaldo, call in at 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got a recipe, a link to a video of Chef Ronaldo making a recipe. We'll get to that in just a few moments. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up our conversation with Chef Ronaldo Linares and talking about Cuban cooking with a focus on healthy, diabetes-friendly recipes.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is this part of your heritage? Do you have experience with Latin or Cuban cooking? Share your recipes with us and Chef Ronaldo. Or do you have questions about how to make something? Call 800-642-1234. 1234. You can also go to the Central Time Facebook page, find the link to a mango salad recipe while you're there.
And we'll take a caller now. We've got Deborah on the line in Brown Deer. Deborah, hi.
Hello, Chef Ronaldo. I work for a family in New York, and the woman was Cuban when her relatives came. Her and her mom made ropa vieja. And I just loved it, and it was amazing. And so I want you to comment on that, and also can you recommend a pressure cooker, because I love cooking with one.
All right, Deborah, thanks. What do you think, Chef Ronaldo?
Well, first, hello, Deborah. Thank you for calling. It's very, very nice to hear your voice. And I'm glad you got some people out here in New York, because we love Wisconsin as well. And the ropa vieja, I love it. I love the ropa vieja. It's such a great dish, such a classic dish. And and that meat, that flank steak, soaks up so much flavor once it's cooked in that sauce. And that's something, that's a dish you could find in the book. You'll be able to cook that classic ropa vieja dish in my book. And you know, and like I said, it is diabetic friendly. As far as you asked about a pressure cooker, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
There's a pressure, it's funny, guys. I'm making right now this beautiful tongue dish. I'm at the restaurant. I'm making this awesome tongue dish with, like, tomatoes and red wine and all these beautiful aromatics. And I use this Power Plus pressure cooker. It's an electric pressure cooker. Has about 8 different dials in their settings for rice, for both regular white, brown, and wild rice, which is very cool. For stews, for soups, even for canning. So it's very versatile, and I love it. I use it for everything. I make stocks. I make, like I said, I make stews. I've made Cuban-style risotto in there. I even made mofongo, which is a plantain mash inside of that thing. And the cool thing about it is quick. And like I said, pressure cooker, I love pressure cookers. Once again, the flavor doesn't go anywhere. It stays there, and it just explodes.
And that flank steak, Ronaldo, is on in your glossary of ingredients. That's a key protein for you.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's a leaner protein. You don't want to stick to leaner proteins, but find the ones that are able to deliver the flavor. You know, the flank steak is beautiful, very, very lean, less on, very low in fat. And what I do with that, you cook it, you kind of you want to somewhat braise it or simmer it, just it through for a while and have some type of acid in the broth to break down the meat a little bit more and tenderize. And once it's tenderized, then you add your ingredients, your sauces, and everything to create that ropa vieja, that old, translates to old cooks. Here's a story. I don't know if it's true or not. My father told me this, but back in the day, you know, back in Cuba, I mean, we're talking about years ago, how they came up with that. So there was a lot of money. They would take old clothes and cook it in all the spices and sauces because they didn't have the meat, and they would eat that, and it would taste great because it's just, you know, it would just do its thing or break down, and they would eat it. So that's kind of the myth behind the ropa vieja, the old clothes. But obviously, you're not going to, we wouldn't do it with clothes, we do it with flank steak.
Interesting. Well, Deborah, thanks a lot for getting us started on that. We're going to take another call, this one from Russ in Monroe. Russ, hi.
Hi, how you doing? This is a great subject. I really appreciate it. Chef, I'm a chef proprietor of a little restaurant my wife and I have, and I've been making ropa viejo and yellow rice and black beans for a long time, and it's just something I learned a long time ago, and people like it, but I'm pretty much making sandwiches with the meat, and what other things do you do with it, and is there another Cuban dish that I should be making that would complement those items?
What's up, Russ? How you doing, man? Thanks for your question. Awesome. You represent a little Cuban food all the way out there in Wisconsin. You could do a lot of things with the flank steak. I mean, you could add it. You know, here's a dish for you. You should get a pen. I think you should do it out there. Do you guys have access to plantains?
Sure. Yeah, we can usually get plantains. Most places.
Yeah. A lot of grocery stores,
right.
Yeah.
And yucca as well, the root plant, yucca.
Fewer and far, further between with yucca, yeah.
Okay.
Plantains,
right.
Yes, yucca, eh.
Okay, so we'll do the plantain. So what are you going to do is you're going to take your green plantain and your sweet plantain. Ratio is 1-to-1. So depending on how big of a portion you're going to make. So you're going to take your plantains, you're going to peel them, you're going to cube it. So to make it, I think also, I mean, it's a little healthier, but also I think it's better than frying it. It gives it more flavor for this dish. You're going to put in a stock, your stock that you make at your restaurant. You're going to simmer it until tender. But I want you to add some bay leaves in there, some oregano, the cumin that we talked about earlier, a little bit of salt and pepper, and then maybe some garlic cloves in there just to add that fresh garlic flavor, which is awesome, and it tends well to the plantains. Once it's tender, I want you to get a strainer and kind of strain out the stock out and reserve some of it, of course. And then I want you to take that mixture and put in your food processor and kind of pulsate it with the liquid little by little to create somewhat a texture like a country style potato. It's not mashed potatoes, but you know, like when you mash up some red blitz potatoes, you get that thick kind of mashy consistency.
Mm-hmm.
Russ?
Yeah.
You know what
yeah, absolutely.
All right, so you get that, and then now you have your what is called mofongo or plantain mash. So with that, you're going to serve it with the beef, the shredded beef, or you're going to create somewhat of a dome. So you get like a soup, like a soup bowl, line it with plastic wrap, place the plantain in there, cover it, flip it upside down, so you get like a little dome. Add a little well in the middle, and you can add that shredded beef on to the plantain.
All right. Well,
yeah,
Russ,
so you
that's your mofongo. And Russ, get us a reservation next Saturday at 5, and we'll try that out there.
And please, if you do that, send me a picture on my Instagram at chef_Ronaldo_. And I would love to see that, man. Would love to see it. And tag me as well.
Yeah. Talking to Chef Ronaldo about his book, Chef Ronaldo's Sabores to Cuba. And Ronaldo, got to ask, we promised, we've got that recipe on linked from the Facebook page. It's some kind of avocado, mango, pineapple salad. This sounds good in summary. Can you tell us about that?
Man, that is a classic kind of Cuban combination. You think of pineapples, mangoes, and avocado. A lot of avocado, obviously. So that's something I had a long time ago. Very long. So I've modified it to my taste and finding the right ratio, because pineapple is very acidic. I mean, it's sweet, but it's very acidic. So being able to find the right ratio to the mango, so both the pineapple and the mango stand out, because they kind of fight against each other. But the avocado, the lime, the cilantro, when you put all that together nice and lightly, it's like a beautiful salsa dance. You know, you have the lady, the partner, you're dancing with them and kind of fighting you a little bit, but not really. You know, she knows that you're leading her, but she doesn't want to.
And you are a salsa dancer, right, Chef?
Oh, yeah. I'm a big time. I love dancing salsa. It's one that I have.
Right alongside the cooking there.
That's right. Well,
yeah.
Chef Ronaldo, thank you so much for joining us today. Can't wait to get cooking some of this weekend.
Awesome, awesome. Thank you so much for having me, guys. It was a great talk. Go Green Bay. hopefully one day I can make it out there. Been a dream of mine to make it to one of the games.
Big
Brett Favre fan, like forever. Like ever since I got here, number 4 fan, and you know, Rodgers fan as well, but not as big. I'm a Favre guy.
Okay.
But but I definitely would love to go down there. And thank you, guys. You guys, hope you're having a kick-butt day out there in Wisconsin. And congratulations on having the number one cheese in the world.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Yeah, I tried it the other weekend. It's pretty good. And thank you so much, Chef. I hope you make it out here.
No problem. Thank you. You guys have a good one.
That's Chef Ronaldo Linares. He's a classically trained executive chef at Martino's Cuban Restaurant in Somerville, New Jersey. We've been talking about his new cookbook. It's Chef Ronaldo Sabores to Cuba, a diabetes-friendly, traditional, and nuevo Cubano cuisine. Again, that recipe, there's a video linked on the Central Time Facebook page, avocado, mango, pineapple salad. That so much of this sounds so good. These are all spices I love. But that salad, that's a great idea to balance that all out with the avocado.
It sounds amazing. And I'm a huge avocado fan. So then the avocado oil. So that was kind of a revelation,
too. I never used that.
I haven't either.
I'm going to try doing some cooking with avocado oil if I can. I don't know.
Try it out.
Find it in stores somewhere. I'm not a big perfume guy, but one smell I like is the smell of books.
And book lovers so far have kind of been left out when it comes to the world of perfume, but not anymore. The owner of the company Sweet Tea Apothecary has tried to capture that niche audience that loves old books and perfume with a new scent, Dead Writers, what it's called.
That audience with some expendable income, I guess. The perfume sells for $80 a bottle. The company said that the smoky unisex smell was inspired by many trips to the library.
Right. It's supposed to have a dominant note of clove and then some vanilla and tobacco notes.
So I don't know. Do books smell like those things?
I guess. I don't don't know, but it's been reviewed in the New York Times. Someone wrote about it and said they couldn't stop smelling it. It did sort of seem to evoke something of books and libraries.
Well, and now you know this about me. I do like the smell of books. Sometimes around the office, we'll get new books here, and some of them smell really good. That's new books, and I've always liked, the general smell of used bookstores and libraries, especially like the deeper recesses of libraries where the older stuff is. Will I spend $80 to smell like that?
Yes.
Probably not is the correct answer.
Maybe they have smaller samples that we could try, but I think you hit on a good idea earlier. Maybe the makers of e-readers could spritz some on there.
Spritz their Kindles and stuff like that to recreate the experience. Well, if you've ever tried this, let us know. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.